This is a game. I don't need this. I just wrote it down this morning, but may expedite things. We'll call it the escape game, or Fugamundi. Fugamundi. And we'll mark it this way. Who does the escaping, and from what? Uh-huh. So we start out here with, naturally, Lehi. You know, we're not going to have room for them here. Better, let's leave the Mundi up here. It means flight from the world, of course, Fugamundi. And the Romans had just put an inscription like that, so we go this way. Naturally, first of all, it was Lehi who did the fleeing. He did the skedaddling. He did the getting out. And we'll see what he's... Well, first of all, I guess the name of the game is that you find in Revelations 18:4, it is Revelations 18:4. Passage we all know. Come out of her, O my people, partake not of her sins, lest ye partake of her plagues. So all these people are running away from something. We'll see what it is. Each time I'm going to refer to the scripture here. Now, Lehi's Jerusalem, we're not talking about that part this semester, is described by his contemporary and friend, Jeremiah. So we'll put this reference on, Jeremiah 5. He's running from Jeremiah 5. We have lots of room there. Oh, here we are, Lehi. Lehi from Jeremiah 5, 25 FF. These are good passages, typical of what he's running away from. 7:4 FF, which I will read to you presently for your delectation. So, 25 and, come on, Jeremiah. Yeah, here we are. 5:25, right at the beginning here, yes. Just a couple of passages here. Your iniquities, this is speaking to Jerusalem in the time of Lehi, your iniquities have turned away these things, and your sins have withholden good things from you. For among my people are found wicked men, they lay wait. He that setteth snares, they set a trap, they catch man. As a cage full of birds, so are the houses full of deceit. Therefore they have become great and waxen rich. They are waxen fat, they shine, yea, they are overpassing, that's Shemin, sign, a fat, sleek glossiness, you see. They shine, yea, they overpass the deeds of the wicked. They judge not the cause of the fatherless, yet they prosper, and the right of the needy, yet they're not judged. Shall I not visit for these things, saith the Lord? Shall not my soul be avenged on such a nation as this? A wonderful, horrible thing is committed in the land. The prophets prophesy falsely. The priests bear rule by their means. And my people love to have it that way. And what will you do in the end thereof? Another passage, this other one in 7. Did I say 7? Yes, 7:4. Following. Trust ye not in lying words, saying, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. Templum Domini, famous saying, you trust in the temple and everything will be all right. For if ye thoroughly amend your ways and your doings, if ye thoroughly execute judgment between man and neighbor, if ye oppress not the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, shed not innocent blood in this place, neither walk upon other gods, after other gods to your hurt, then will I cause you to dwell in this place, in the land that I gave to your fathers, forever and ever. But they have to move out. He has got to go, you see. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, burn incense unto Baal, and walk after other gods whom ye knew not, and come and stand before me in this house, which ye call my name, and say, we are delivered to do all these abominations because we are in the temple? Is this the house which is called by my name become a den of robbers in your eyes? Remember, that's what the Lord said when he drove the money changers out. My father's house is a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves. He's quoting Jeremiah here. Delivered unto you by these abominations. Is this house which is called by my name become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, even I have seen it, saith the Lord. You're not getting away with anything. God is not mocked. And as we're about to find out. So who else makes a mistake? Well, of course, then Nephi makes his great escapes. He's the great escaper. What's he escaping from? Well, of course, the desert, the perils of the desert, especially from Laman and Lemuel, and from the slough of Jerusalem. This is what Laman and Lemuel represent, and so we'll put it this way, L and L. You have M and M's, why not L and L's? First Nephi, 17, just reference passage to show the sort of thing he's running away from here. And what did they do? Remember, they didn't want to go. They were trying to kill him repeatedly. He was always escaping from them and always escaping from the trials and dangers of the journey. But in the 17th chapter, this is what the brethren want. They're reluctant of having been brought along. They say, we've got to go back home. They plan to kill both their father and their brother in order to go back to Jerusalem to this sort of thing, which is what they've been escaping from. You say, so it's 17, 20, and so forth. Oh, I got 17. Never get it right. It's a long, long chapter. My brethren thought I was about to believe this. Thou art like unto our father, led away by foolish imaginations of his heart. See, this is the objection. They think, no, the other side has a case too. They're escaping to something else. They're escaping from, Lehi is escaping from a prosperous city, and their sons resent it. Everything's going to be all right. We're safe. And Nephi is leaving all their precious things behind, which is a foolish thing. He's escaping. And they want to escape from the desert and get back home where they can live comfortably. Thou art like unto our father, led away by foolish imaginations of his heart. He hath led us out of this land. We've wandered in the wilderness these many years with our women and children and so forth. Behold, these many years we've suffered in the wilderness when we might have enjoyed our possessions and the land of our inheritance. They've given this up all for gracious living. They've given it up for this, you see. This is the thing that Nephi's fleeing from, through a much more austere type of life. And even if they'd stayed in Jerusalem, he wouldn't have lived the way they were living, you see. They're getting away from it. The Lord forces us to change, see. We know the people of Jerusalem were righteous people. They kept the statutes and the judgment, just as Jeremiah says. They went to the temple and all that. And all his commandments according to the law of Moses, wherefore we know they were righteous people, and our Father has judged them. So here's another escape, and from what? Remember what he's escaping from, what to what? And we know what he escaped to, the life in the desert, the rigors and so forth. But as soon as they got in the new world, Nephi had to make another escape. Not as soon as they started quarreling again, remember? The big fight. And from the New World Settlement, he escaped out by his people, by himself, with as many people as he wanted, as wanted to go with him. And they lived the law and its strictness and austerity, and that we find in, well, we better put it on here. And this is in, well, a good example is 2 Nephi 5 and 10, I would say here. This is what they're escaping for, 5 and 10. And you know what they went out to? A rigorous and, I say, an austere life. And they escaped from Nephi 5 and 10. This is what they were escaping to from. You might know. Oh, and we did observe to keep the judgments and the statutes and the commandments of the Lord in all things according to the law of Moses. That was basic, you see. But they went out. They wouldn't believe the warnings. I took my family and Zoram and all the rest and all those who would go with me and would believe the warnings and the revelations of God, and they went out. Again, they're fleeing from the destruction. Come out of her, partake not of her sins, lest ye receive of her plagues. So he makes this, and he's got another colony, and now Mosiah escapes from it. It's his turn. This colony goes bad. You see, Jerusalem's gone bad. They've gone bad after they settled here. Now Nephi goes out and settles his own colony, and it goes bad. This seems to happen. This is a pattern, isn't it? So it's Mosiah who's commanded to escape in a dream and take his people. Mosiah, and what's he escaping from? I think a good example is Jacob. 2FF. What he's escaping from is that eloquent passage. There's plenty in Jacob, as you know, here. And this is what he's running away from. The people immediately started to do this when they got right at the beginning here. Oh, I just got a chapter. Do I have a... I got a verse here rather than a chapter. Better put the complete one. I got Jacob 2 something FF anyway. Well, weighed down by anxiety and so forth. Oh, here, this is what he's escaping from. The reign of the second king began to grow hard in their hearts, have wives and concubines. I should write a few things. Well, the first chapter right at the beginning, because of faith and anxiety, began to be anointed of men. Now, this is it, see. 13, let's say 2:13 following. That's a good example. See, it's just full of them. You don't have to invent them or anything. We know what they were running away from, what was dangerous, and what was going on here. And this is the way we know these passages. The hand of providence has smiled upon you, so you're prosperous, and some more obtained more abundantly than others. So You walk lifted up already. You see, they're still in the wilderness. When you wear stiff necks and high heads because of the costliness of your apparel. This is already beginning in the family. This is Lehi's own family. I mean, this is his son, Jacob. And they're the first generation. They've already done this. They're already walking after escaping from Jerusalem. The costliness of your apparel, persecuting your brethren because you think you're better. God doth condemn you. His eye can pierce you. This is iniquity and abomination. Think of your brethren like yourselves. Then the appeal for equality. And that's what you're proud in your hearts for the because of the things God has given you. God has given you the things that you're proud of, and so you must be righteous. Such things are abominable. One being is as precious in his sight as the other. They keep rubbing in that equality, but the people won't take it. They like this better. See, we have two totally different ways of life, two totally different economies, two totally different disciplines, as described here. Well, who's the next person to escape them? It is Benjamin. And what Benjamin, remember, he is the son of Mosiah. And he undertakes a great reform. It's a great reform of speech he gives. People have got to get back on the track again. And we can find this in Mosiah. Mosiah 4 and 2 are good examples. And 5, that's a great speech of his. 11, and Mosiah 5 and 7. You know what he's escaping from. The inequality, I would that this inequality should be no more, he says. Think of your brethren like unto yourselves. They've acquired riches and all this sort of thing. The Lord will bless you, all right, but you don't have to go bad because of it. And, you all know Benjamin's great speech, so we don't need to go into that. Always remember your own nothingness, remember, and the greatness and goodness of God. The 2:5:11. Yes. They viewed themselves in their carnal state less than the dust, and they have called the atoning blood. He really cuts them down to earth. Remember, this was a great national assembly they were celebrating after years of victory. They practically worshiped Benjamin. Years of victory and prosperity, success and everything. It was a great national assembly to let the eagle scream, and they were going to stand tall and everything. And this whole everything he says, Benjamin just cuts them down to nothing. You're less than the dust, he says. Don't get the idea that you're anything at all. And then you'll be equal, and then he says, then you will feel to rejoice. But as long as you're going to have this way of doing it, well, are your hearts changed? Are you born of him this day? See, and then the fifth chapter, they have to get, he gives them a new name, a new title. They take the vow to keep the covenant. They take the covenant, and it's the covenant of Moses, the covenant he gives them. This day has he begotten you, it's a new birth, and he says he's going to give them a new name. They're going to have a new way of life entirely. Well, how long does it last? Not very long, but in the time of Zenith, here's Zenith. Zenith, he has a reason for escaping. He goes out, what is he escaping from? He's escaping from this everlasting tension and unpleasantness with the Lamanites. It can't go on like this, he thinks, when he finds the Lamanites aren't such bad people after all. He wants to make concessions. And he goes out, as you know, and he leads the settlement, becomes a king within them because he's deceived by the Lamanite king. But Zenith goes out, and we find that in Mosiah 9, for example, what he's escaping from. Mosiah 9 and 1 will say, Zenith, having been taught all the languages, the fathers of our first inheritance, he sent it to spy. Then I saw there was much good among them, and he wanted to save them and so forth, which happens. And then the 6th and 8th verses here. I went to the king, and he covenanted with me that I might possess the land. And he commanded his people to depart out of it. So there was a settlement, and everything was already was settled. And so we should put these references here, I suppose, where the Zenith goes out to relieve the tension. And it was going out. He goes out entirely new community. They settle there, and they're in the midst of the Lamanites. It was quite a project. And 9:1, and 6:8. Just a few examples. You can find lots of them. And the next one. Then who goes out from this colony? Well, then we have already. His son is the wicked King Noah. So Alma has to run away from Noah. So we have another escape. And Alma goes out by himself, remember, founds his own church in the wilderness by the waters of Mormon and all that, and he's escaping from Noah. Moses 11, boy, I'm not writing very well. Moses 11, 2:7:15, various passages here. And 18, 8, F, 27F and so forth. That's 27. These are passages. That's supposed to be a 15. See, there's a great... Well, you know what the situation is when he goes out there. And it sounds just like the Dead Sea Scrolls people. You remember, it's very disciplined. They all work and so forth. And the priests visit them, and they do their work, and they baptize, and they live holy lives out there. And that's much too strict for most people. So, Alma goes to the land of Helam. He settles in the land of Helam, and he's driven out of that. Remember, they're able to make an escape to the land of Helam, and then Alma again from Helam. He's escaped because of he was running away from Amulon. Remember, Amulon just wouldn't let them even breathe. He came down so hard. He was so jealous of the Lamanites too, because the kings made him a king. The main Lamanite king made him an under king. We get this Mosiah, we'll say, 24 and 7. Oops. And they finally ended up, this time they ran away, and he ended up in Jerusalem. And Mosiah was just waiting for him, open arms, because he brought the priesthood and the knowledge of the church and its organization, which he had gotten from Abinadi and from the scriptures, being a direct descendant of Nephi anyway, and he was able to help Mosiah out. When Mosiah hesitated, he says, we can't launch the church in a big way here until... And then Alma came and they started working together. But what happened? Immediately, the first year, general defection. And Mosiah and Alma put their heads together. What do we do? Alma says, I don't know what to do with these people. And the king says, I don't know what to do with these people. The only thing to do, we can excommunicate them. And they started on a huge scale. And soon the people, see, it became because it says they were so scattered out, they couldn't keep control of all the churches out here, and they became more and more independent. And though the priests were sent out to them, there were all sorts of troubles, local troubles, and could they hold the church together? They couldn't. Soon it far outnumbered the others, and so we have Alma and Mosiah. And Mosiah, and what they're having to fight against is a general defection here. General defection. That's everybody falling away, getting disinterested, going their own ways. People aren't willing to live that strictly. That's the whole point, you see. We do not like the law of consecration, whether we like it, whether we say we do or not. I mean, whether we covenant to keep it or not. And here, good passages for that are Mosiah, 27, 7 to 10 is pretty good. Yeah, now we got to have more room up here, so we'll just add the next people that defect and go away. Alma's had that trouble. Then what happens, you see? Then Alma's son, he's among the defectors. He's among the troublemakers. But you know how he got converted. And then he escapes. He says he escapes from the bonds of hell, actually. He makes an escape. He has to. This is Alma Jr., Alma 2 here. And he makes his escape in the, where he talks about it is... I'd say Mosiah, 27, where he describes what he's been through, and he's escaped, and he doesn't want anybody else to have to go through that. And it is a matter of escaping. He says, I've been delivered, I've been snatched, I've been saved. This is a spectacular escape. So what does he do? Well, the sons of Mosiah go out, they make an escape, sons of Mosiah. They're nailed for political jobs and none of them will take them, so they all run away on missions. It's a sensible thing to do. And so what they're escaping is the double burden of royalty, we're told. Remember, they're warned about it. Their father tells them nobody wants to be... Their double burden of royalty is the burden on the king himself. Make an honest king suffer terribly, he says, and the burden on the people if they get an unjust king. One way or the other, there's an unfair burden either way, and you can't escape it. The royal burdens, we'll say, the two, and an easy lie the head, lies the head. And the speech on that particular subject is Mosiah 29. Got more room now. 29 and 25 to 29. Oops. 29 to 29. 29, 16 FF, we've already got that one. 16 following, that's a long speech. 16 FF, and especially 33 and 33 and 34. This is, the just king has to suffer, and this is, with an unjust king, everybody suffers. And then finally, Alma, where does Alma go? Remember, Alma is now... Mosiah puts Alma He doesn't go, but he's put in charge of everything. Now we're coming to this part. Now we're going to have a happy time. Alma, the charismatic Alma, everybody was crazy about Alma, but now he'd been converted thoroughly. And how? And he's in charge not only of the church, but he's the high priest in a sacral society, judge. He's the chief judge, as well as the high priest. He's the head of the church and the state. Anybody writing this would say we're in for a golden age. Anybody writing a book this time, but last, a new age dawns with Alma, ha ha ha. And what happens? Before the year is out, the whole thing starts coming apart. Well. So that's, let's say 126, this is what he escapes to. The general corruption, his collapse, as a matter of fact, which puts amount to, is in Alma 1, first chapter, 16 to 20, see what's happening. So we come up to this point now, and we'll find plenty more of escapes and collapses as we go here. But we had come to these most popular verses here in Mosiah. As I say, we mentioned the last time, Mosiah 2. And Mosiah 2 and... And was it 3? Can no longer be, yes, it is 3. No longer be, spread the knowledge of every kingdom to tell you. Well, he gives him a speech here. The angel speaks to Uzziah, and the prophecies of Christ. Oh, it's Alma. I think I've been reading from Alma, the beginning of Mosiah, instead of the beginning of Alma. That's how far gone I am. Yes, it's not Mosiah 2, it's Alma 2. Yes, here. In fact, it's Alma 1. Here we are. I say this is the one we talk about. They did not wear costly apparel or anything like that. 29th verse here in the first chapter. And because of the steadiness of the church, they began to be exceedingly rich, having abundance of all things. But in that, they were still righteous. This is the interesting point. They were righteous for a whole year. Whatsoever they stood in need, abundance in flocks and herds and fatlings, they had all they needed, even silk and fine twined linen. You know, that's an interesting thing, won't go into silk now. And thus, in their prosperous circumstances, they did not send away those who were naked. The question is, how long could they resist the corroding effects of riches? 4 years at the outside, as we learn. The last 2 years being years of war anyway, in Alma 4 and 6, it tells us what happened. But what is the problem here? We see this a great deal. Notice it. The reason they were able to get along, they did not set their hearts upon riches. They were liberal to all, whether out of the church or in the church. No respect for persons, those who stood in need. No such thing as deserving, poor. If you need, that's that, and all there is to it. But here are these very popular verses with the LDS. They must be taken in full context, of course, with 26 and 30 and the rest. And... So we have this business. Why does God enrich the righteous there? And as we see in Alma 29:31 here, and Brigham Young gives the answer to that many times. It's very effective. Now, one whose talent and initiative and dedication and industry have been demonstrated is now in line for the next test, for the next step. That's why. So naturally, he's given these riches to test him, to see what he'll do with them. That's a totally different test of character, of a different kind of character, you see. Work itself doesn't sanctify. We're told it's possible to work like the devil or to work like demons. He works hard. And Alma 4 and 6 and 10 and 4 and says, what you gain by your industry is not holy gain. James said, because of your work, you've received these riches. That's fine. You should receive them, of course. But it's neutral. It's not holy. It's not one way or the other. You can see that. The qualities for success in business are required in much higher degree in any other line. As far as that goes, we have 100 millionaires here. But how many first-class scientists or authors or painters has the country produced, or composers or poets? Or generals, even, as far as that goes. Very, very few first-class men in there, but almost any in his dog, but in his dog, says Brigham Young, can become a millionaire, as far as that goes. But what you do with it? That's the first test. Well, the man has passed it. He's been good. We've given him. Now he's been conscientious. We'll load the stuff on him. Now let's see what he does. This is the real test. And there are far more important qualities than this. What is missing in our candidates and our big men today, for example? They seem to be very shallow shallow lot. The greatness is very rare. We clamor for it. We slaver over it when we have it, even if we're not so sure that this person really is great or not. But there are very few. Now comes the next test then. God gives a capable man wealth and power, as Brigham says, to see what he will do with it. To the righteous, youthful Nimrod. Now, Nimrod was the first person to establish kingship, fortifications, armies, and things like that. But Nimrod was a very righteous king when he was young. And he had great intelligence and great strength, and the Lord rewarded him for his service to the human race by giving him the bowl. Because the men at that time, now this is a universal, as you find this everywhere, men at that time were threatened by the beasts. They couldn't defend themselves against the wild animals, which were very large and ferocious. I mean, cave bears and saber-toothed tigers and creatures like that can be rather dangerous. And they weren't up to it. So he gave Nimrod the bow to protect the human race. But Nimrod very soon discovered by using the bow he could put the human race at his disposal. So he turned it against them and made himself the first emperor, the first king, and ruled everything. He was given this tool, you see, to help people, and he found out, boy, what a profit this will give me, how great I can become now that I have the bow. And he did. And he used it, and he organized, we're told, the first armies, the first empires, the first tyranny, and all this sort of thing, because he misused the treasure, the great gift God had given him. And so everyone must pass the wealth test, and it's the hardest of all. Remember, Satan's office is to try men and to tempt him. And how does he do it? You can have anything in this world for money. That's the way he's going to tempt you, of course. And we're to be tested to see if we'll be true and faithful in all things whatsoever the Lord commands. He's very experienced in this, and he knows what the number one temptation is. Nephi, 1 Nephi 22:23, he tells us, the four things, and he repeats it again in 3 Nephi 6:15. You get these. The things we can't resist are, in this order, gain, power, popularity, lusts of the flesh. And they're all interrelated. They all build around ego, pride, and so forth. Here's an interesting passage from an article by, a speech by Brother Woodworth, who's on our faculty here, Brother Warren Woodworth. Did I bring it along? I hope I did. I always forget these things. Come on, speech. Maybe I have it here. Oh, yeah, here it is. He's quoting here from a very big industrial. This is incidentally from a book that I have, too. I could have read from that book, but I would have got started and never let up. He just has some discrete quotation to show us what the problem is. A top executive describes his work experience in several different companies this way. We always saw signs of physical affliction because of stress and strain, ulcers, violent headaches. In one large corporation, the chief executive officer ate Jellucil by the minute. That's for ulcers. He had a private dining room and a private chef, but he never ate anything but well-done steak. That's all he could eat. He went on. He says, you're always on guard. Did you ever see a jungle animal that wasn't on guard? You're always looking over your shoulder. You don't know who's following you. Now, this doesn't seem to be the order of Zion or sacred things where they had all things in common. There were no poor among them. A man who wants to get to the top of the corporation, not for money, not for the money involved, as we're talking about, the four things that Nephi talks about are first, power, then gain, then popularity, fame, and then sex, and all the rest that goes with the lusts of the flesh. They all go together, you notice, if you've watched your primetime TV, as I do very faithfully, of course. I did Friday night for once because my son was on a soap opera. In fact, he was through the whole thing. He had quite a big part. It was the most sordid, the most silly, the most disgusting, the most sickening thing. But he says they have to come up with a new story every day. They have to keep 10 stories ahead. So the writers get together and just cook any combination of sordid relations. Somebody's married to who, they're divorced, somebody's two-timing something, they've had an abortion, somebody except, it goes on and on and on. It's utterly nasty. And here my son is cashing in on it. But I never could correct that kid. But he's the most faithful member of the church I've ever known. Oh, boy, is he dedicated. He makes me look like an atheist, as far as that goes. Well, and so he says, after a certain point, how much more money can you make? In my climb, I'll be honest, money was secondary, but it was there, see? Unless you have tremendous demand, yachts, private airplanes, you will get to a certain point, money isn't that important. It's the power, the status, the prestige. Frankly, it's delightful to be on top and have everyone call you Mr. Ross and have a plane at your disposal and a car driver at your disposal. This is King Noah, you see? When you come to town, there's people to take care of you. When you walk into a board meeting, everybody gets up and says hello. I don't think there's any human being who doesn't love that. It's a nice feeling. And then he talks, here's an interview with a candidate for the presidency of the United States. You'd know his name if I told you what it was, but here it goes. He says, running for president feels exactly like being president. The ordinary experiences of life melt away. They're replaced by constant swirl of limousines and money, jet planes and prepared statements, secret service men and gorgeous political groupies. There's almost an infinite sense of power and prestige. It feels wonderful, which is why it's so terrible. Book of Mormon always zeroes in on pride as head of the list, of course, and it's the first of the different sins in the classic list. Yes, I particularly remember the feeling of riding alone in a limousine and a motorcycle escort. Everybody was peering at me. To them, I was a blur, power in motion. To me, they were a frozen milieu of still, dumb, gawking faces, as if captured by strobe light. During those moments, I knew the glory. The president himself knows, and it was an impressive experience. Had it continued, I have no doubt that it would have succumbed to it absolutely. Unless you have a general like MacArthur, who had immense ability, of course. It's the uniform you salute, and it's an interesting thing that the military that live for rank are never have any delusions about it, because they know how people get promoted, and it's the uniform. As we're always told, it's the uniform you salute, not the person. He doesn't think he's made a great achievement. Maybe they needed him something, had a friend in the right place, and so on. But this sort of thing, it gets to us, you see, to the atrocious assumption, and he says it leads to, I have to succumb absolutely. Succumb to what? To the atrocious assumption that I was more important than other people. Think of your neighbors like yourself. You are all alike. I would have this inequality done away with you, says King Benjamin. And I would not have been equal to have done so. Just human, if your repeated experience is that you're in motion, everyone else is frozen on the side of the road, it's only reasonable to conclude that you are more important than they. Expect that you run the universe and expect you to run the universe for them. You don't feel as though you are being corrupted by power. You feel as though you are intelligently responding to empirical evidence. And that's power's greatest corruption, the tragic and universal misconception by the wielder of power that it isn't corrupting him. Of course, the same thing with money. Of course, that's the famous dictum of Lord Acton, remember? All power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So look out for power. Well, so we have these things, as 1 Nephi 22:23 calls them gain, power, popularity, and lust of the flesh, and 3 Nephi 6:15 calls them power, authority, riches, and the vain things of the world. Well, who can handle these? Now look, if you're going into the eternity, if you're going to rule thrones, dominations, kingdoms, princedoms, powers, if you're going to go on and rule and reign in the house of Israel forever, you can't go on with a defect like this. It'd be mortal to find out the least you're here to be tested. See, this life is a time of probation. And this is the hardest test of all. Can we trust you for infinity as far as that goes? Can we need me, which means, of course, to be as absolute in your own power? Can you be left completely alone for endless ages without doing infinite damage? Well, of course, who can? You make the average person president of a committee in three, and he starts acting like Chinggis Khan. I've seen that happen again and again. You know, the world we live in. Well, and so our wealth, and this is answered, the questions posed in these verses here, 29 and 30 and 31, the people had the wealth and they still were righteous. And so the question arises, are wealth and virtue compatible? We all like to think they are. Today we're actually preaching that sexual promiscuity and virtue are compatible. People are actually trying to believe that. They want that too. Actually, this vice is less absorbing, less persistent, less demanding, less predatory, less hypocritical than the pursuit of gain. Sex is way down the list compared with the other one, certainly in the Book of Mormon. But this problem here is treated by no one as well as Brigham Young, so here we go. I'm going to read you some passages from Brother Brigham, who was our greatest businessman and the great leader, the greatest leader in American history. Nobody performed anything like what he did as a leader, remember? George Washington's the only one within shouting distance of that. So here we are, page 245. I'm going to read you some passages here. He starts out here. Remember the passage? I just noticed this here. I hadn't intended to read it. This is thrown in. I say no extra charge. This is this. Anyway. We often hear the strange perversion of that saying, the idler shall not eat the bread of the labor, which of course means that the idle rich shall not eat the bread of the laboring poor, which has been the way throughout history. The laboring poor is ground down, supporting the rich. And Brigham says, man has become so perverted as to debar his fellows as much as possible from these blessings and constrain them by physical force or circumstances to contribute the proceeds of their labor to sustain the favored few. Now, he discovered the conflict at an early age. Can you have them both? And he said, I sought for riches when I was 19, but in vain. There was always something that kept telling me that happiness originated in higher pursuit. Doctrine and Covenants 6 and 7, beginning with the 6th chapter, the Lord, the first specific command, once the conditions are agreed on with the Lord, have been clearly explained and accepted by those, the brethren, to carry on the work. What must be demanded, there must be faith and all the other things, and this is what you must have, he says. But then he gives the first specific rule, the first explicit order in clear and ringing words, seek not for riches, but seek for wisdom. Clearly marked alternatives, not seek for wisdom more than riches, but seek for the one and not for the other. They are mutually exclusive. You cannot serve God and mammon, the Lord says. You must necessarily hate the one and love the other, and you must serve God with an eye which is single to his glory. Now, this is a common rationalization here, and Brigham has a lot to say about it. Well, we read about the case of Brother Hamilton, didn't we? Yeah, Hamilton. Hammond. Ooh. He says he sought for riches, but in vain, kept telling him that happiness originated in other pursuits. At the very beginning of the church, Joseph Smith said, God has often sealed up the heavens because of covetousness in the church. You're not going to have covetousness and revelation. And so this is more or less chronologically arranged. In 1855, Brigham pointed the way, which is the love of knowledge and the love of wealth, just as that seventh verse of the sixth section says, seek not for riches, but seek for wisdom. They're like antithetical sets of glands, he says. They render each other ineffective. It is possible for a man who loves riches in the world to overcome that love, to get knowledge, to understand until he sees things as they really are. Then he will not love the world, but see it excuse me, as he is. And then he says, I desire to see everybody on the track of improvement, that when you so love your property, as though your affections were placed on the changing, fading things of earth, it is impossible to increase in knowledge of the truth. Then in 1860, he says, there are hundreds in this community, he's talking about the little community in the valley there, who's getting quite big there, who are more eager to become rich in the perishable things of this world than to adorn their minds with a knowledge of things as they were, are, and as they will be. No man who possesses the wealth of wisdom would worship the wealth of mammon. And he says, if we go on lusting after the groveling things of this life, which perish with the handling, we shall surely remain fixed with a very limited amount of knowledge, and like a door upon its hinges, move to and fro one year after another without any visible advancement or improvement until retirement comes and then you die of ulcers. Man is made in the image of God, but what do we know of him or ourselves when we suffer ourselves to love and worship the God of this world, riches? When you see, then a year later, he says, 12 years later, when you see the Latter-day Saints greedy and covetous for the things of this world, do you think their minds are in a fit condition to be written on by the pen of revelation? We frequently hear our merchants say they can't go do business and then go into the pulpit to preach. It doesn't seem to bother them anymore. A man or a woman who places the wealth of this world in the things of time, in the you can balance and you can have the one and the other. Have a balance. Oh no, he says, no balance. A man or woman who places the wealth of this world and the things of time in the scales against the things of God, wisdom of eternity, has no eyes to see, no ears to hear, no heart to understand. The covetous, those who are striving continually to build themselves up in the things of this life, which we call success, will be poor indeed. They will be poor in spirit and poor in heavenly things. This same lack of comprehensiveness, there's a thing Joseph Smith talks about. He says you mustn't be contracted. Be liberal in your feelings. You must not have contracted minds, he goes on. Let us not narrow ourselves up. Then Brigham says, this same lack of comprehensiveness of mind is also very noticeable at times with some men who happen to accumulate property, and it leads them to forsake the spirit of the gospel. Does it not prove that there is a contractedness of mind in those who do so, which should not be? Business is by its very nature narrowing. Take, for instance, the financial circus, and we're seeing it today, of course, with the insider trading and the takeovers and so forth. It all depends on secrecy. It all depends on limited information. the financial circles, he says, the commerce of the world. Those businessmen, when they have their opponents, they, with all the secrecy of the grave, I might say, will seek to carry out their schemes unknown to their opponents in order that they may win. Like a man at the table with cards in his hands, unseen by anybody himself, he will take advantage as far as he can, exactly the game they're playing. That's the stock market. So says the politician, so says the world of Christendom, so say the world of the heathens, and it's party upon party, sect after sect, division upon division. We are all for ourselves. Well, we're told that that's the right thing. It's a privatized world. Well, finally, he says, he tells the well-heeled saints, he says, he puts it strong, there are lots more of the same effect, but he says, keep your riches. And with them, I promise you, leanness of soul, darkness of mind, narrow and contracted hearts, and the bowels of your companion, compassion will be shut up. Even so, Joseph Smith had warned, those contractive feelings that influence the children of men who judge each other according to the narrow, contracted notions of men, while the great parent of the universe looks upon the whole human family with fatherly care and paternal regard. That reads like a paraphrase of King Benjamin, doesn't it? So this is the theme we have here then. And what other nice ones do we have here? Oh, well, and he goes on, and remember, in the first, in the Pearl of Great Price, he that hath eternal life is rich. We mentioned the people that had everything and had nothing as far as that goes. So this is what happens. You notice, this is very important. In their prosperous certains, they behaved themselves, and there were no deserving poor, and they were equal. But those who didn't belong to the church, take another business. They're taking to sorceries. This is what you do, games of chance and luck. The stock market sort of thing. It says, to sorceries, to idolatry, to idols, to babblings, to envyings and strife, gossip about this, wearing costly apparel, dressing for success. All one picture, notice, all centered around personal gain. All the primetime mix. Envying and strife, wearing costly apparel, being lifted up in the pride of their eyes, lying, thieving, robbing, committing whoredom. See, this is really competitive stuff going on. All manner of wickedness. Nevertheless, the law was put in force. They had laws and they kept them. You can't keep laws for everything. Inasmuch as it was possible. That's an important qualification. They were doing all these wicked things, but you can't put a person in jail just for being mean or being cruel or for oppressing on a debt. You can't do that. You have to let people do what they want to, and so this goes on. So we have two definite societies. The one they did not set their hearts on, were liberal to all, and the others were in for all they could get. Were they grabbing, risking for success and all the rest? In the life, it was known, therefore, there was much peace until the fifth year of the reign of the judges. Then everything breaks loose. So this lasts only for 4 years. Alma got them off to a good start, but right away, see, they were acting like this. And you see, these two societies are very different from each other. There's not much chance of compromise between them. They won't allow it, you see. So comes the fifth year, contention among the people. Now this Amalekai, he takes advantage of it. He's a shrewd person, he's able, he's effective, he's a born winner, and he's a member of the Nehor Church. You see, the Nehor Church is going to be the church from now on. Notice in the second chapter, this man, notice his quality. He was a very cunning man, he was wise, he was sharp, as to the wisdom of the world. And after the order of the man who slew Gideon, he was a member of the Nehor Church. And he drew away many people after him. Already we're told, remember, just before when Alma got in, lots of people were apostatizing, had to be cut off, and lots of people had to be excommunicated, it tells us. Remember, lots of people were cut off from the church, and even more of them just left of their own free will. They just apostatized, all joining the Nehors. This is what's happening. And it's going on here, and it picks up speed with this man Amalekai, who's taking advantage of the motion. And this was alarming to the people of the church. They knew that according to the law, that such things must be established by the voice of the people, because he puts it on a different level now. It's not just religion, or not a big shot like Nehor, the evangelist. He wants to be king. Well, this is something else. They just abolished the kingship. What's going to happen now, you see? So naturally, it gets them worried. He gets a big party following him, and he goes for the big one. Kingship is out of fashion for only 5 years here. He gets followers and so forth. And so, where do we have this one here? Well, it alarmed the people of the church. It should alarm everybody else, for they knew that such a thing should have to be established by the voice of the people. Not by the voice of the church, but the voice of the people. They knew they'd be shut out if that's what happened. And if Amalekai won his victory, it would be legal. because the church as such had no voice in the civil government. They couldn't vote as member of the church. But if he won the election, we said they would do all things by the voice of the people, and if the people choose the wrong thing, that's just too bad for them, that they'll be responsible. So he could legitimately be elected king, as far as that goes, by their constitution, doing things by the voice of the people. And he had a real power base. It was his intent to destroy the Church of God. That was his immediate obstacle that he had to get rid of. And he polarized public opinion. Notice, the people assembled together. They divided into separate bodies, having much dispute and wonderful contentions one with another, like a political convention. Everything going on, splitting up, and so forth. The voice of the people came against Amittai, so he didn't win. But like Satan in heaven, Satan wasn't cast out of heaven, you see, for voting the wrong way. Most of the people did the first time, the second time, but he refused to accept the verdict. And he was going to resort to violence with a third of the hosts of heaven, and therefore was cast out in a twinkling. There was no war in heaven. The word is polemos that's used, and Joseph Smith explains that very well, incidentally. But he was cast out for refusing to accept the popular vote. So here we go. And it came to pass. They went right ahead. They wouldn't accept that. Like Pinochet wouldn't accept it. We've had this happen. Well, this happens again and again in Iraq, another classic example. Dictators just don't accept defeat. They'll hold a free election, but it goes the wrong way. Everybody screams fraud and so forth. Today, this is increasingly common, of course. No one ever admits any wrongdoing today, any need to repent, any feeling of guilt. There is nothing wrong with us. It was bad advice I got and so forth. I don't remember. Won't incriminating events, circumstances, and so forth. We don't need to obey the laws they were made by. We don't agree with them. They're bad laws, so we won't keep them. We don't like the APA, which was made by another administration, and so forth. And this goes on, the world we live in. Amalekai did stir up those who were in favor and anger against those who were not in his favor, and they wouldn't accept the verdict. So they go ahead with their own program in contempt of the Constitution, which they had adopted just 5 years before. So already you see that we're in deep trouble. And they consecrate Amalekai king, and he commands to take up arms against their brethren that they might be subject to him. The church is an obstacle now. You can see that a society of freaks, he was thought socialistic freaks, they had to get rid of them. They never would accept him in this case, so what would happen? And, well, they would have to. So, but that was his obstacle. And they were called Amalekites, and the remainder were called Nephites. Notice, it was just what they called them. It was just a matter. The next chapter is on the subject of race, the whole next chapter. We come to that. But here, they call themselves Nephite. It was just a political designation. That's all it was. Therefore, the people of Nephi were aware of the intent of the Amalekites and therefore did prepare to meet them. And they prepared to meet the Amalekites. And now we see what had happened. The whole thing had been planned out by Malachi beforehand. He had already made a secret arrangement to join forces with the Lamanites. He chose his strong point, not in the center or anywhere near the center of the kingdom, but right on the borders, right at the crossing of Sidon with the Lamanites on the other side, so they immediately came to his aid. He took a strong point on a hill there, which was a classic point of defense on the border, and that's where he expected if he was sore pressed, the Lamanites would join him, and that's what happened. So they're going to have a rough time when this happens, I see. Time's nearly up now. So they were prepared to meet him. So, but he did, and it came to pass, this is what he did, very shrewd man. Came to pass that the Amalekites came upon the hill Amnihu, which was east of the river Sidon, which ran by the land, by the land of Zarahemla. We learn otherwise that was on the border. That was the boundary line, in fact. And there they began to make war. That was their rallying point, and that's the point from which they wanted. They wanted to choose the time and place of meeting the enemy. That gives you a great advantage, and that's what they did here. Of course, they took that position and waited for Alma to attack then and make war on the Nephites, and they're to draw them on as the aggressors. Well, Alma being chief judge, he went up with his captains at the head of the army. Now, Alma has three jobs, you see. He's the head of the church, he's the head of the government, and chief judge, and he is also the head of the army. He is a man with a full-time job. So he attacks the base then. We'll have to stop there and leave things in a state of suspension.